Welcome to episode 539 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In today's podcast, I'm going to be addressing a very, very high yield topic for the USMLE exams. To be honest with you, this podcast applies to step one, step two CK, and step three. And in today's podcast, I'm going to be addressing a topic I call 50 high yield corticosteroid factoids to know for the USMLEs. 50 high yield corticosteroid factoids to know for the USMLEs. So let's jump right into it. First things first, we know that the most important corticosteroid is cortisol. And cortisol is made in the adrenal cortex. So we know that the adrenal cortex has three layers. The zona glomerulosa, where you make mineralocorticoids. The fasciculata, where you make glucocorticoids like cortisol. And the reticularis, where you make sex steroids, especially androgens like DHEAS. That's factoid number one. Factoid number two, if a person has a state of cortisol excess, what kind of electrolyte abnormalities would you expect? Well, one thing people don't realize is that cortisol has some mild mineralocorticoid activity. So because it has mild mineralocorticoid activity, it can make you lose potassium in your kidneys. That can cause hypokalemia. And it can also make you lose hydrogen ions in your kidneys. And that can cause a person to have a metabolic alkalosis. All right, factor number three. What if they give you a question about a person that has a history of Hashimoto's and this person then has hypotension, skin hyperpigmentation, and hyperkalemia? Well, I would really hope you're saying, wait, Divine, sounds like this person has Addison's disease. Remember, another thing for Addison's disease is primary adrenal insufficiency, and it's an autoimmune disease. In fact, one thing I've found that's very useful on the USMLEs is that when the USMLEs are testing one autoimmune disease, they will often give a past medical history of another autoimmune disease. So, for example, this person has a past medical history of Hashimoto's, and then now they have hypotension and skin hyperpigmentation. That's Addison's. And let's explain why. Well, the thing is, Addison's autoimmune style, you destroy your adrenal cortex, not your adrenal medulla, your adrenal cortex. So you pretty much develop a cortisol deficiency and an aldosterone deficiency. So for these folks, that low cortisol they have, you're not going to have any negative feedback. So their ACTH is going to rise. And again, as you know, ACTH doesn't drop from the sky. It's made from a precursor molecule known as POMC, pro-opiomelanocortin. So pro-opio. So it gives rise to beta endorphin, melano, MSH, melanocyte-stimulating hormone. That's how you get the skin hyperpigmentation. And then cortin, ACTH. So the ACTH is going to be high. And again, with that aldosterone deficiency, obviously, they're not going to be reabsorbing sodium from their kidneys, so they will have hyponatremia. They cannot excrete potassium from their kidneys. They will have hyperkalemia. And they cannot excrete hydrogen ions from their kidneys. So they're going to hold on to those hydrogen ions. They're going to get a metabolic acidosis. If you want to get super specific, it's going to be a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis. All right. Now, factoid number four. What if they give you a question about a person that uses steroids chronically for whatever? And this person then, you know, is in a motor vehicle accident or requires a surgery, and their blood pressure is just persistently low, and you're giving them pressors, giving them IV norepinephrine, levofed, and they're not getting better. I would hope you're thinking of some kind of adrenal crisis. So remember, if a person uses steroids chronically, it's going to cause a suppression of their HPA axis. When you suppress the HPA axis, again, it's not a big deal because you're getting exogenous steroids, but over time, your adrenal cortex is going to atrophy. And again, it's not a big deal as long as you're facing the same level of stress in life. If you get to a situation in life where your stressors increase, then you're going to get in some very, very deep trouble because your, say, for example, surgery or a medical illness or trauma or whatever, you're not going to be able to upregulate your HPA axis to make extra cortisol for that extra stress you're going through. And again, remember, cortisol has a permissive effect on the sympathetic nervous system, especially like its vasoactive effects. So you're going to see these people get thrown into an adrenal crisis. So for those people, you want to give them a stress dose of steroids in that circumstance. Okay, factor number five. What if they give you a question about a person that has used the albuterol inhaler for a very, very long time? I mean, they've been using it more frequently. And you notice that, man, this person seems to be using it more and more, and it doesn't seem to be controlling their asthma symptoms. Well, I would hope you're saying, Divine, the next thing we should add to their pharmacotherapy is an inhaled corticosteroid. Many times, if the first rung on the ladder for asthma management is a SABA, a short-acting beta-2 agonist like albuterol. But if that stops working, you need to go ahead and tackle an inhaled corticosteroid. All right, factor number six. They give you a question about a COPD patient. Remember, most COPD patients, in terms of management, we typically go with a short-acting agent, like a short-acting muscarinic antagonist, like ipratropium, or you can use a short-acting beta-2 agonist, like albuterol. But after that, if their symptoms are not well controlled, typically you're going to give them a combination inhaler that involves a LABA or a LAMA of some sort and an inhaled corticosteroid. So they're going to get a combination of something like tiotropium and an inhaled corticosteroid like fluticasone or whatever. You're going to combine those two things. Or a LABA, a long-acting beta-2 agonist like salmeterol or formoterol plus an inhaled corticosteroid. So remember, you can use inhaled corticosteroids if you're looking at points number 5 and 6 to manage asthma and COPD chronically. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that has a lot of itching and on the skin, and they tell you that, oh, you see a lot of red patches on the skin, they may have some plaques or whatever. If you see this, I hope you're saying, wait, Divine, this person probably has eczema. Remember, another name for eczema on the USML is atopic dermatitis. Now, eczema, how do we treat it? Well, the way we're going to treat eczema typically on the exams is a combination of two things. You're going to use an emollient to, you know, keep moisture on the skin, but you're also going to use a topical corticosteroid. And it's actually kind of weird, but it's pretty high yield to know that eczema is associated with a mutation in a gene known as filaggrin, One of these weird factoids you think too low yield for the exams until it pops up and you're like, whoa, where did that come from? Well, now you've heard it. And also, it's important to know that there are certain diseases that have an association with eczema. So remember things like Wiskott-Aldrich. Remember, it's an immunodeficiency disease. They'll have low platelets. They'll have eczema, and they'll have recurrent infections, and it's X-linked recessive, so it's only going to be found in boys on your test. And then don't forget Jobe syndrome. That was the old name. The current name is hyper-IgE syndrome, where you have very high levels of IgE. You'll see them have a lot of, like, cold abscesses on their skin, and their IgE levels are extremely high. That has a very strong association with eczema. All right. Now, remember another, so that's factoid number 7. Now, factoid number 8, remember, when a person has an asthma exacerbation, you can absolutely give those people steroids. Most times when you're having an asthma exacerbation, you're going to get IV steroids. Typically, we're going to start off with the short-acting bronchodilators first, but in addition, you're going to get IV steroids. Okay, now how about factor number 9? How about a COPD exacerbation? When a person has a COPD exacerbation, many times they're going to have increased sputum production. They're going to be short of breath. They're going to have a rise in their PaCO2 above baseline. Those people have a COPD exacerbation. COPD exacerbations, the primary management, again, you can use short-acting bronchodilators, but those people are also going to get IV corticosteroids. In fact, it's actually pretty high yield to know that when you have a COPD exacerbation, typically for the next few days when you're discharged, you're going to be given like a few days worth of oral steroids, just again to prevent recurrence of that COPD exacerbation. All right. Now, that's factoid number 9. Factoid number 10, if they give you a question about a person that seems to have an issue with, you know, they're always pulling out stuff from their nose every morning, you know, they just always feel their nose is always congested, and you're going to notice that these people, they seem to have deviation of the nasal septum, I would really hope you're thinking of something known as chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyposis, The drug of choice for actually managing that disorder is an inhaled corticosteroid. Now, please do not forget something that is salient but extremely important. People that use NSAIDs, they actually have a high risk of polyposis in the nose. Because remember, NSAIDs inhibit cyclooxygenase. If you inhibit cyclooxygenase, you're going to have more flux. Because remember, arachidonic acid can be converted to leukotrienes by lipooxygenase, or prostaglandins by cyclooxygenase. So if you take an NSAID and inhibit that cyclooxygenase pathway, you're going to have more flux through the lipooxygenase pathway. And that's going to cause you to make a ton of leukotrienes. And all those leukotrienes you make is going to make it really hard, right? You're going to be making a lot of polyps in your nose and whatnot. That aspirin-induced asthma, which these days we call aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease, has a very, very solid association with nasal polyposis. And remember, you can also see nasal polyposis in people that have cystic fibrosis, just FYI. All right. Now, factoid number 11. What if they give you a question about a patient and this person has asthma that's like super difficult to control, and you're told in the Q-stem that, man, this person's eosinophil count is pretty high, and you have these pulmonary interstitial infiltrates. Well, if you see this, I would hope you're saying, wait, Divine, this person has ABPA. This person has allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis. Remember, the treatment of choice for allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis is going to be corticosteroids. You're going to give those people oral steroids. Now, do not forget that those people, you're going to do a skin test, and you're going to see some positivity with aspergillus antigens. All right. Factoid number 12, what if they give you a question about an African-American female that has like dry cough, you know, has bilateral hyaluronopathy? That's pretty classic. That's sarcoidosis, right? Remember, sarcoidosis, if they're asymptomatic, you're not supposed to treat them. But if they have symptoms, you should go ahead and give them steroids. Steroids are the treatment of choice for sarcoidosis. And don't forget, people that have hypercalcemia from sarcoidosis, and they ask you, oh, how do you treat the hypercalcemia from sarcoidosis? I would really, really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, I'm going to use a steroid as well. Because remember, if you control the problem, the inflammation, the problem will go away. Because think about it. Sarcoidosis is a granulomatous disease. So because it's a granuloma, there's going to be lots of epithelioid macrophages. Those macrophages, they make a ton of 1-alpha hydroxylase. That's going to convert calcidiol to calcitriol. That calcitriol is going to cause you to, you know, that's active vitamin D. You're going to reabsorb a ton of calcium from your gut. You're going to have hypercalcemia. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? This person has HIV. And, you know, for the past few days, the person has been very short of breath, very dyspneic. And you check their labs, they're very hypoxic. And again, you get a chest x-ray and you see pulmonary interstitial infiltrates. And you notice that, wow, those people, they're just really, really struggling, really, really struggling. And, you know, they tell you that you get an induced sputum sample and you see silver stain positive organisms. That's going to be pneumocystis jervetzi. Now, remember, pneumocystis jervetzi is the most common cause of interstitial pneumonia in HIV patients. So how do we manage it? Well, we're going to manage it with a combination, usually with just trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. But one thing you never want to forget is that sometimes you need to add corticosteroids, especially if your P little AO2, your arterial oxygen partial pressure, is less than 70, just to improve outcomes in those people. All right, factoid number 14. What if they give you a question about a person that has a skin disorder? You know, they're not doing really well. They have a fever. And they tell you that they have all these lesions on their skin that if you just apply gentle pressure to those lesions, they pop easily. So that's Nikolsky positive. I'd hope you're saying, oh, Divine, yeah, that's pemphigus vulgaris. Remember, pemphigus vulgaris, it's an autoimmune disease. You make autoantibodies against desmosomes. Typically, that can be managed with topical steroids, although you can also manage it with rituximab. Oh, sorry, not topical steroids, with oral steroids. You can give the person oral steroids or rituximab. And then remember when we talked about, so this is factor number 15 I'm going into. So remember when we talked about Addison's disease? That's an autoimmune disease. Well, because the adrenal cortex has been damaged and you're not making cortisol or aldosterone, you want to go ahead and manage those people by giving them something to replace cortisol, like a steroid, and something to replace aldosterone, like fludrocortisone. Remember, we typically don't have to replace the androgens in people that have Addison's disease. All right, factor number 16. Now, it's pretty high yield to know that steroids, especially IV steroids, we tend to use them for flares of things, for flares or exacerbations of certain diseases. We've talked about how you can use IV steroids for asthma exacerbations. We've talked about how you can use IV steroids for COPD exacerbations. Well, please don't forget that you can also use IV steroids for exacerbations of things like multiple sclerosis, things like lupus, things like inflammatory bowel disease. You can give IV steroids to manage those things. And then what if they give you a question about a newborn? So this factor number 17, a newborn that is super hypotensive, has diffuse skin hyperpigmentation, has hyponatremia, has metabolic acidosis. If you see something like this and has hyperkalemia, if you see something like this, I really hope you're thinking about the classical case of CAH, congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Remember, CAH is the most common cause, is a deficiency of 21-hydroxylase. So when you have a 21-hydroxylase deficiency, you're going to make a ton of DHEAS, but you're not going to be making cortisol. You're not going to be making aldosterone. So it's going to be like you have Addison's disease. It's going to look like you have Addison's disease. It's pretty high yield to know that those people are also going to be treated with steroids to replace the cortisol they're not making and fludrocortisone. If you notice, the electrolyte anomalies are going to be eerily similar to people that have Addison's disease. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a female? So it's factor number 18. A female that, you know, for the past couple of months, she's been very tired, feeling very fatigued, has a lot of right upper quadrant pain, you know, is nauseous, has a rash on the skin. And you notice that their liver labs are elevated. Their ASTs, their ALTs are elevated. But their alkaline phosphatase is completely normal. Their bilirubin is completely normal. And you notice that this female has primary amenorrhea. She's infertile. When you see something like this, what should you be thinking about? Well, I hope you're saying divine. This sounds an awful lot like autoimmune hepatitis. It's actually an autoimmune disease. And remember, it's going to be associated with antibodies against smooth muscle. So anti-smooth muscle antibodies. Another association you may see on your exams are those anti-liver kidney microsomal antibodies. That's actually pretty high yield to know for your test. And remember, these people are going to be managed with corticosteroids. All right. Now, factoid number 19. What if they give you a question about a person that has recently had some kind of viral infection, or a person that has lupus, and you notice that their hematocrit is completely fine, their white blood cell count is completely fine, but their platelet count is crazily decreased? If you see something like this, I hope you're saying, oh wait, divine, this person has ITP. This person has immune thrombocytopenia. Remember, ITP is an autoimmune disease. You pretty much make autoantibodies against GP2B3A. So that's going to cause the splenic macrophages, when they see antibodies bound to your platelets, to completely obliterate those platelets. That's why these people have thrombocytopenia. Remember, the first line treatment for ITP is corticosteroids. It's the first line treatment. Although if that doesn't work, you're going to slide to second line, which is IVIG. If that doesn't work, you're going to slide to third line, which is a splenectomy. Take those splenic macrophages that are causing havoc out of the equation and problem is going to be solved. All right. Now, what if they give you a question, factor number 20, about a lady that has proximal shoulder pain and weakness and her ESR, CRP is elevated? That's pretty easy, right? This is going to be polymyalgia rheumatica. Remember, the management of choice for polymyalgia rheumatica is going to be corticosteroid therapy. And then factor number 21, they give you a question about a lady over 50 or close to 50, and this person has like eye pain, blurry vision on one side, and you notice that, man, their temple is really hurting on that side. And again, high ESR, high CRP, think of giant cell arteritis. It's a large vessel vasculitis. Giant cell arteritis, which sometimes we call temporal arteritis. Remember, the treatment of choice is going to be steroids. You're going to give steroids first, actually, before you even start worrying about a temporal artery biopsy, because that's actually an ophthalmologic emergency. You don't want this person to go ahead and go blind. All right. Now, factor number 22, they give you a question about a person that has proximal muscle weakness, you know, so trouble climbing stairs, trouble lifting objects with your arms. And they tell you that, oh, they have like redness around their eyes. They have these, weird growths around their knuckles and things like that. Those are Gautran's papules. The stuff I described around the eyes, that's the raccoon eyes. And you see the proximal muscle weakness, and you notice that their CPK is pretty high. When you see this, I would hope you're thinking of a myopathy like dermatomyositis. Although remember, the close cousin is also polymyositis. These folks, again, the treatment of choice for them is typically going to be steroids. You're going to use steroids to manage those things. And then what if they give you a question about a child? So factor number 23, a child that has chronic joint pain, but for the last 2-3 days, this child's eye has been hurting, and this child's ESR, CRP is elevated. I would hope you're saying, wow, divine, this person kind of sounds like being a child. They have GRA, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. Remember, GRA, especially the oligoarticular kind where it's like 1 to 4 joints that are affected, is associated with anterior uveitis. In fact, these people do require annual slit lamp examinations of the eyes just to make sure that they don't have anterior uveitis. So this person has anterior uveitis. Again, it's an ophthalmologic emergency. You don't want these kids going blind. So what are you going to do? Makes sense. It behooves you to go ahead and give those people steroids, topical steroids. You're going to give steroids in the eye. That's the treatment of choice actually for anterior uveitis. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question, factor number 24, about a patient that has MS, that over the last few hours has had very severe eye pain, and they tell you that they have an afferent papillary defect? Well, if you see something like that, I hope you're saying, wait. Divine, this sounds an awful lot like optic neuritis. Remember, optic neuritis can cause issues in people that have MS. It's inflammation of cranial nerve number 2. And the management for that disorder is going to be steroids. You're going to give IV steroids, and you're going to diagnose it with an MRI. But again, it's an ophthalmologic emergency. You have to make sure you treat it so the person doesn't go blind. Okay. And then for factoid number 25, in fact, I'm going to title this factoid the steroid and cyclophosphamide trio. The steroid and cyclophosphamide trio. Why am I talking about this? There's a series of disorders on the USM list that are managed with the combination of steroids and cyclophosphamide. And this is actually a pretty high yield list to know. So what's this list? Well, the first one is going to be Wegener's, granulomatosis with polyangiitis. Remember, that has a CNCA association. The next one is going to be Churg-Strauss, which these days we call EGPA, eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. that's going to be managed with steroids and cyclophosphamide. And then remember, if you see a young male smoker that is puking blood and has blood in their urine, they have nephritic syndrome, and you have this rapid decline in renal function, that's RPGN, rapidly progressive glomerulonephritis with good pasture syndrome. We're also going to manage those folks with steroids and cyclophosphamide. And just quick segue before we jump to point number 26. If you're taking step 2 or step 3 within any time soon, I will strongly encourage you to consider, you know, the two classes I have. I have a class today called the Last Minute Review. It's a 3-hour class, but we go over in a very short time a bunch of very high yield things for step 2 and step 3. It's going to take place over Zoom between 7 and 10 p.m. Eastern time this evening. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website. I can give you some more information. And then also next week, I have a 20-hour step 2 CK step 3 course. It's going to be taking place from Monday to Thursday from 5 to 10 p.m. EST every day. It's going to be over Zoom. Again, it's 20 hours, but you're going to learn a lot. And if you know me, you know that I'm not a person to just throw factoids at you. No, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you how he's going to present in a question. I'm going to explain the pathophysiology. I'm going to make integrations. And I'm going to remove a lot of fluff. I'm going to focus primarily on what you need to know for your exams. There's tons of people that have taken this class and they've done extremely well. I'm pretty sure I've had scores as high as the 280s from people that have taken these classes. I've gotten a lot of extremely positive feedback on it. So if you're taking your exam soon, remember step 2 CK scores matter these days. I would encourage you to reach out to me and I can give you some more information on the class. All right, let's go to factoid number 26. So what if they give you a question about a person that has a history of sickle cell disease? Remember, if you have sickle cell, your spleen is not working, so you're going to struggle with encapsulated organisms. And you're told that, man, over the last 2 days, this person has been having severe headaches, high fevers, and the person has nuchal rigidity. And then you do a lumbar puncture, and you notice that, wow, this person, you see gram-positive cocci in chains. Well, if you see something like this, I hope you're saying, oh, wait, Divine, this person has pneumococcal meningitis. Well, how do we deal with pneumococcal meningitis? Obviously, we're going to give IV antibiotics. We're going to give IV antibiotics. You're going to give something like ceftriaxone, for example. But don't forget that when a person has bacterial meningitis, especially from strep pneumo, it is super high yield to know that those folks need to get steroids as well to improve their outcomes, Okay, factor number 27. What if they give you a question about an old lady that is itching a lot down there, right? Has very itchy vulva, and they tell you in the Q-stem that this thing kind of looks like crinkled paper. Looks very thin vulva. Well, I hope you're saying, ooh, Divine, this sounds a lot like lichen sclerosis. Well, lichen sclerosis, typically the way we're going to manage it is with a high potency topical steroid like clobetasol or halobetasol. A high potency topical steroid. You see, again, I promise you this podcast is super, super, super high yield. All right. Now, factor number 28. What if they give you a question about a person that has moon faces, a buffalo hump, and all those things? And they ask you for the most likely cause. But what's the most common cause of Cushing syndrome? It's actually pretty straightforward. The most common cause is exposure to exogenous corticosteroids, like a person taking steroids chronically for whatever disorder. Although remember, the second most common cause is going to be Cushing's disease. Cushing's disease is when you have a pituitary adenoma that's making a ton of ACTH. Remember, that one does not suppress with low-dose dexamethasone, but it's going to suppress with high-dose dexamethasone. All right, factoid number 29. Remember, what if they give you a question about a person that is on chronic steroids and then their A1C has risen? Well, it's going to be pretty straightforward. Remember, steroids, they pretty much antagonize the actions of insulin, so they can cause a person to become hyperglycemic. In fact, we try to be careful about giving corticosteroids to people that have diabetes, although sometimes you're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place and you got to do what you got to do. All right. Now, factor number 30. What if they give you a question about a person that is on chronic steroids and then they've gotten in 2 accidents within the last few months because they're having trouble reading road signs at night? Well, that's cataracts. Remember, steroids have a very strong association with causing a cataract. That's something that's very high yield to know for your exams. And then factor number 31, what if they give you a question about a person for the last 2 days, they've had crazy high fevers, and they tell you that, man, in fact, they give you a picture of their extremities, looks like blue-black, and they tell you that, man, the margins are rapidly expanding. That's pretty easy, right? That person has necrotizing fasciitis. Remember, necrotizing fasciitis has a very strong association with corticosteroids. And remember, when a person has neck fasc, you're going to debride the lesion and you're going to give IV antibiotics. But debridement is something you absolutely need to do. If not, their limb is going to disappear. All right, factor number 32. Now, one thing that's actually high yield to know is kind of related to something I've talked about already. But remember, we said that when a person has pneumocystis pneumonia and their PaO2 is under 70, you're going to give them TMPSMX and in addition, you're going to give steroids. But Remember, if you're chronically on steroids, you're going to become immunocompromised. That immunocompromise from taking steroids chronically can actually increase your risk of PCP pneumonia. So that's actually something that's pretty high yield to know for exams. Our friends at the MBMEs actually love to test this factoid a lot. You know, you see a person that's on chronic steroids for something like giant cell arteritis, and then they develop like, you know, hypoxia, shortness of breath, they're puking a lot, they're coughing up a lot of stuff, you know, sputum wise, and you see in, you know, the sputum sample, you see Silverstein positive organisms, that person has literally developed pneumocystis jervetii. Remember, it's not only people that have HIV that can get a PCP pneumonia. And then factor number 33 with steroids is that, remember, glucocorticoids, they can actually activate your osteoclast. So you can see people that have been taking steroids for a long time, they actually have a pretty high risk of osteoporosis. In fact, sometimes if people have to be on steroids for a long period of time, we typically try to put them on bisphosphonates as well as osteoporosis prophylaxis. So you may see these people having like fractures with minimal trauma. Just going to keep that in mind that, wait, steroids can actually activate osteoclast. They're going to chew up your bone. You're going to have osteoporosis. Okay, factor number 34. If they give you a question about a person that has like really severe bloody diarrhea, and they tell you that, man, they have right upper quadrant pain, you do imaging, you see a liver abscess, and they tell you that you see a lot of protozoans in the person's stool, I would hope you're thinking about Entamoeba histolytica. The thing is, Entamoeba histolytica causes bloody diarrhea. It's one of these protozoans that causes bloody diarrhea. But that's not all. When people are on steroids and they have E. histolytica infection, they tend to have really, really bad outcomes. This is one of those things that people don't pay attention to, but I promise you, it's actually pretty high yield to know for your exams. All right. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that has an asthma exacerbation or COPD exacerbation? So this is factor number 35. And you notice that, you know, they've been treated and, you know, by the next morning, they're acting all crazy. They're saying, ooh, I'm hearing someone chasing me. I'm hearing someone speaking in my ear. Blah, 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 blah. When you see something like that, that person has steroid-induced psychosis. Remember, steroids can make a person all crazy. It can cause psychosis. How are you going to manage that? Well, you're going to go ahead and give an antipsychotic. Although sometimes supportive care is all you need, but you can give them an antipsychotic. Okay, factor number 36. What are the skin changes we see with people that are taking steroids? Remember, you can see things like moon faces, buffalo hump. You know, they can have atrophy of their muscles. Remember, steroids can cause lipodystrophy. And they can cause muscle atrophy. They can cause muscle weakness. Just something you want to keep in mind. Now, one thing I want to say real quick. Is there a HIV drug class that also causes lipodystrophy? I wonder what it is. I would hope you're saying, oh, Divine, that sounds a lot like your protease inhibitors, That's a very high yield factor to know for your test. Again, you may notice I'm really trying to keep this podcast short because I want to make it like very short, sweet, but incredibly high yield. All right, let's go to factoid number 37. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, has very severe asthma, they're chronically on, you know, oral steroids, and then this person over the last few days, they've been having trouble walking upstairs, lifting heavy objects, and they tell you that the creatine phosphokinase is like 50. It's not very abnormal, or it's like completely normal. Well, if you see that, I hope you're saying, wait, Divine, this person has a steroid-induced myopathy. Okay, and then factor number 38, what if they give you a question about a person that is on, you know, chronic steroids, and the person's been getting a lot of accidents. They tell you that they keep bumping into cars on their sides, you know, on the like city streets and whatnot. That's pretty easy, right? That's glaucoma. Remember, in glaucoma, remember, first things first, steroids have an association with glaucoma, but that's not all. Steroids, by causing that glaucoma is going to make you lose your peripheral vision. When you lose your peripheral vision, you're going to be having all these side swipes and things like that. You're going to be having accidents because your peripheral vision is just not great. All right, factor number 39. What if they give you a question about a person that, you know, got, you know, was treated for like an asthma or a COPD exacerbation, and then this person is now having very significant abdominal pain, and the person is coughing up blood? Well, I would hope you're really thinking about peptic ulcer disease. Steroids have an association with peptic ulcer disease. Steroids do actually a ton of stuff. They're going to make you make more gastric acid. That's going to raise your risk of ulcers, and they're going to decrease the production of prostaglandins. When you make less prostaglandins in your GI tract, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. I kid you not. I mean, think about it. Why do you think NSAIDs cause peptic ulcer disease? Because they inhibit cyclooxygenase. If you inhibit cyclooxygenase, you're not going to be making prostaglandins. That's going to get you in some hot water, right? And remember, you know, so how do steroids actually inhibit prostaglandin production? Well, think about it. They inhibit the enzyme phospholipase A2. Think about it. Phospholipase A2 converts membrane phospholipids to arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid is the feedstock that is acted upon by cyclooxygenase for you to make prostaglandins. So if you inhibit phospholipase A2, you won't make arachidonic acid. If you don't make arachidonic acid, you'll make prostaglandins. Less prostaglandin production is going to make you to make a ton of gastric acid, and that can cause you to have peptic ulcer disease. All right, now, factor number 40. What if they give you a question about a person that uses inhaled steroids for like their asthma or COPD, and then this person has been having like dysphagia or like painful swallowing? That's odynophagia. Well, you want to think about candidiasis. Remember, people that use inhaled steroids especially, they have a pretty high risk on the US MLEs of developing oral or esophageal candidiasis. Obviously, for those people, you're going to give them oral azoles or an oral nystatin. That's going to help their condition. All right. Factor number 41. What if a person starts having forceful contractions at less than 34 weeks? What are you going to do? Well, I would hope you're saying, oh, divine, I'm going to go ahead and give them betamethasone in 2 doses to promote fetal lung maturity. Remember, steroids promote fetal lung maturity. If you're going to labor at less than 34 weeks, you got to receive steroids to promote surfactant production to promote the maturity of the fetal lungs. All right. Now, factor number 42, what if a person is started on corticosteroid therapy and you notice the next day their white count is like 25,000 or some crazy high number? They'll try to trick you on your exam and say, oh, this person has a new infection because they're immunocompromised from the steroids. No. Remember, steroids cause demargination of neutrophils, so they can really raise your white count. In fact, sometimes if they want to mess with your head on exams, they'll just slap the term leukemoid reaction on it. Steroids literally cause that demargination. It's going to raise your white count a ton. So they can give you a question about a person that has COPD or asthma, had an exacerbation, got IV steroids, and then the next day their white count is extremely high. It's because of that steroid-induced demargination. And then factor number 43, remember, there are actually some chemotherapeutic regimens that include steroids. The two high-yield ones to know are CLL and Hodgkin's lymphoma. CLL and Hodgkin's lymphoma, those people's chemotherapeutic regimens actually include corticosteroid therapy. Okay, factor number 44. What are some skin changes you may see in people that have taken steroids? I've talked about the lipodystrophy and, you know, buffalo hump, moon faces. Don't forget that steroids, they inhibit your fibroblasts. So you're going to have, you know, easy bruising. You're going to have thinning of your skin. You're going to have skin atrophy. Just something to keep in mind. All right, factor number 45. What if they give you a question about a person that is on steroids, you know, chronically for whatever, and then they have this pain in their right hip? You know, it really, really hurts. They're having trouble ambulating on that hip. They're limping on that hip. That's going to be avascular necrosis. Steroids have a very, very strong association with avascular necrosis. Sometimes on the USMLEs, they actually call this osteonecrosis. All right. Factor number 46. What if they give you a question about a person that has a history of breast cancer? And then they tell you that for the last 2 days, this person has become paralyzed in their lower extremities. And then they tell you that when you palpate their back, you know, they have like pinpoint tenderness along their back. That's pretty easy. And you, many times those people's alk force will be extremely elevated. They may have hypercalcemia or malignancy. Think of spinal cord compression from steroids. Remember, you're going to diagnose that with an MRI, but those people need steroids pronto to reduce that swelling around your spinal cord. All right. Factor number 47. Basically, I'm going to call this the second line factor. Remember, steroids are second line for a bunch of things. They are second line for gout. Remember, first line for gout is an NSAID. They're also second line for pericarditis. Remember, first line for pericarditis is going to be an NSAID plus colchicine, All right. Now, factor number 48. What if they give you a question about like a child, you know, that has a lot of muscle weakness, and this child is hypertensive, this child has hypokalemia, has metabolic alkalosis, and they tell you that, man, this child's aldosterone is very, very depressed, almost undetectable, their renin is very, very depressed as well, but they tell you in the Q-stem that they have an elevated free cortisol to cortisone ratio. When you see something like this, I want you to think of a disorder known as SAME. SAME means the syndrome of apparent mineralocorticoid excess. Syndrome of apparent mineralocorticoid excess. It's actually a genetic disease. It's autosomal recessive chromosome 16. And you have a mutation in a gene known as 11-beta hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase 2. 11-beta HSD2. 11-beta hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase 2. The thing is, what does this gene product do? Well, what it does is it converts cortisol to cortisone. Because your body understands that, man, cortisol has some mineralocorticoid properties. So what your body tries to do is it tries to express this enzyme so they can convert cortisol, which has mineralocorticoid properties, to cortisone, which is inactive and does not have mineralocorticoid properties. But if you don't have this enzyme, well, you're going to get in trouble. you're going to have a ton of cortisol. It's going to give you those mineralocorticoid-like properties, and you're going to have hypertension, hypokalemia, metabolic alkalosis. And obviously, that hypertension is going to turn down your renin angiotensin aldosterone system. So your renin is going to go low. Your aldosterone is going to go low. And again, that's why these people have a high level of free cortisol to cortisone, because their cortisol is rising, but they're not able to make converted to cortisone. Remember, licorice can also cause the same problem. Remember, licorice contains something called glycerinic acid. Glycerinic acid actually has the ability to inhibit this 11-beta-HSD2. And in addition to that, it actually decreases the gene expression of 11-beta-HSD2. That's going to be an acquired cause of that same, the syndrome of apparent mineralocorticoid excess. And then let me ask you this. If a person has Cushing syndrome, what do you expect their cortisol, their eosinophil count to look like? That's factor 49. Well, their eosinophil count is going to be low. Remember, eosinophils, the steroids cause apoptosis of eosinophils. So when people have cortisol excess, they're going to have a lowered eosinophil count. But think about if you have a steroid deficiency like Addison's disease, you're going to have a high eosinophil count because you're no longer causing apoptosis of your eosinophils. So your eosinophils are going to have a much longer half-life. That's why eosinophilia is part of the differential diagnosis of Addison's disease. And then factoid number 50, they give you a question about a person that has AFib and their eyes are bulging. Obviously, that person probably has Graves' disease and they have proptosis. Remember, in Graves' disease, you have these thyroid-stimulating immune globulins. It's an autoimmune disease. So those things pretty much stimulate the TSH receptor. So your entire thyroid gland is going to be stimulated. You're going to make a lot of T3 and T4. So your TSH is going to be suppressed. But those antibodies stimulate the TSH receptor. But remember, is there any other cell in the body that has TSH receptors? I wonder what. Maybe fibroblasts. So if those antibodies, those autoantibodies stimulate your fibroblasts, it's going to cause them to make things like glycosaminoglycans. And that's going to deposit in your eye, and that's going to cause proptosis. So how can we fix this problem with steroids? Well, give steroids. Because steroids, what do? They inhibit fibroblasts. If you inhibit fibroblasts, you're going to inhibit the production of those extracellular matrix things like glycosaminoglycans, and you're going to fix that proptosis. So I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, I promise you, this podcast, you're going to get multiple questions right on your exams from this one podcast. And just real quick, again, I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams and all the Comlex exams. And I have these review courses. Again, I talked about the last minute review for step 2, step 3 taking place today, and the 20-hour step 2, step 3 class taking place next week between Monday and Thursday over Zoom. Again, they are not lectures. If you're expecting a lecture, you're in the wrong course. These courses focus primarily on questions. But again, you'll notice that with those questions, you learn so much. I've literally had people that between day 1 and day 4 of the class, you know, they came in, they took a practice test before day 1 of the class, and then by the end of the class, they've improved by like 30 points already. So I'm not saying everyone will have that improvement, but I've heard that story more times than I can remember. And then I also help with ERAS applications, recommendation letters, personal statements, and things like that. I've done this for many years. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email and I can give you some more information. And then remember, I have these podcasts on Apple, on Google, and on Spotify. So just check those out. But again, if you want the worksheets, so this podcast has a worksheet. If you want the worksheet, I'll encourage you to go to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com, and you see a PDF below the podcast episode. You can download the worksheet. It's like a quiz that if you listen to the podcast and really understand what's going on, you can actually fill out that worksheet. And then you have something you can just study to review the material very quickly again. And then finally, I have another website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. Every week I try to post one or two podcasts. I just uploaded one this morning about following your heart. I post one or two podcasts every week. We're usually less than 10 minutes, but I use the Bible to discuss a life lesson. Many people have actually listened to those and found it to be helpful. It's a website, divineinterventionlifelessons.com. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with it called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. And again, I also have my YouTube channel. Check that out. That's where I post many of the videos that I make. So thank you for listening to me today. I will see you in episode 540. Have a wonderful day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.